keep up with the guests and topics on What's the 411 with Sharon Kay. Friend us on Facebook and Twitter. Search under Sharon Kay's 411.
We're happy to have all of you tuned in today and listening to the Broadcast 411 show. Our audience is the best. I tell you all that all the time. You're the best, and that's why I love you. Today's book is Healing Racial Trauma, The Road to Resilience. And if you are a regular listener or new to the broadcast, you know we talk about these issues of healing, resilience, racial and ethnic issues on the show regularly. So this is a new book out, and we wanted to give you all an idea what it's about. Maybe you want to run out there and pick it up, and hopefully you do. Let me introduce the author, Sheila Wise Rowe.
Hi.
How are you doing today?
I'm fine.
Good.
Yeah.
Sheila is gotten her education in counseling, psychology, yeah, and in particular abuse and trauma. So I'm certain you have a lot to say on this particular subject, since you know, you, these things cross paths. Did one lead to the other? Did that lead to your wanting to you know, help people with issues of abuse and trauma, because you have ministered to people like that?
Mm-hmm. Well, part of it, it's my own story.
Okay.
And in the book, I do share some of my story and my own journey with healing around racial trauma, particularly.
Okay.
And I, in the early 60s, went through a voluntary busing program in Boston, and that was, it had a lot of really, I want to say, deep wounds that came out of that, that experience. And then subsequently, there was mandated court busing in Boston, and that was crazy and volatile. And those experiences left a mark on me. And I think, coupled with some other experiences of just really wanting to help other people who were dealing with trauma, with emotional issues, whether it was abuse or addiction. And so I initially got a bachelor's degree in in sociology and minor in psychology, and then went on to get a master's in counseling psychology. And
okay.
I've been actually practicing in the field initially as a social worker and a licensed marriage family and family therapist, and probably it's about 30-something years now. Yeah, so it came out of my own experience, and then also over the years working with women, men, couples, families.
Now, this would have been this time frame I'm seeing here in chapter one, the 60s.
Yes.
Times were much different then. And our ability to absorb is different then than now. I don't know how we're absorbing it now, if it's better or we've learned how to maneuver through it. But it was a lot of cruelty going on in that time frame. So I'm going to use my imagination about how old you are, because I think I'm around the same age as you. So I get it. I totally get it. Now, let me ask about the busing. And can you share a little bit more about the trauma that went along in your life, was ingrained in your life as a result of that? What happened?
Yeah. So I, the educational system in Boston at the time was really bad. So for the community, in communities of color, particularly black communities, there were teachers who didn't want to be there. The textbooks were old. There weren't enough seats for students. it was clear that we were getting a substandard education. And so the parents really came together and tried to get the school committee to make some changes and to increase funding, because we saw, like, this, as the neighborhood changed from a kind of a mixed neighborhood to one that was predominantly black, the amount of resources were cut in the community. So whether it was educational funding, whether it was trash pickup, we saw like a dramatic shift and a change. And so parents were basically demanding equality, and they were really getting the message from the school committee was that, no, everything is fine. In many ways, you know, the term these days, it's called gaslighting. And, you know, we're, you know, we're basically fed this misinformation or distortion, and we're supposed to just believe it and buy it. And so the black families particularly fought against that. And so they discovered that in the city, if you could find an open seat anywhere in any of the communities of Boston, you were allowed to transfer out of your area to that community. So there literally were white schools that were neighboring the black communities, like Roxbury and Dorchester and Mattapan, that were getting more funding than the black community was getting. So the voluntary program was called Operation Exodus, and so I was a part of that program, and it was one where we were welcomed but not welcomed. And we were welcomed in that, you know, it was the law that we had a right to be there. However, the just the experiences that I had, my siblings, my older sister and I and my brother were the first three that went, that were part of the Operation Exodus program. And so we were accused of all sorts of things. We were accused of stealing. We were accused of, you know, causing, I was accused of causing someone to fall. You know, my sister, one incident was she told the teacher that this kid called her the N-word and, you know, called her a nigger. She told the teacher. The teacher washed her mouth out with powdered soap. And the kid, nothing happened to him. And those are the kinds of things that we just, on a regular basis, we were, you know, demeaned, we were maligned, you know, going to this mostly white community was, it was, in a way, it was really shocking because we had come from a community where it was mostly black folk, and now we're in this other community where we're getting this message where we don't belong, and that we don't actually have what it takes to survive in that environment. And even that our intellectual ability was really questioned. And so and there was a lot of wounding that came out of that for me, and just a lot of insecurities about who I was as a, you know, a black girl, and, you know, was I smart enough?
Let me ask you this.
You know, was there a future for me? And I could say that for all of my siblings who went through that, that was the challenge of what – you know, can we actually believe that there's more? And I want to say that the challenge, too, is because our my parents initially were a part of the Nation of Islam, so they were under Malcolm X, and I think that was the impetus for them being involved. And when he was assassinated, that they left. But we got kind of like this mixed message in a way, in that our parents were saying, yes, you can do it, you know. You know, they were really hopeful, and yet the message we got in school was very different.
So was there a lot of time spent in your family, you know, talking amongst themselves about, now, you know, the white folks is like this or like that. I mean, was there any of that going on so you could at least, you know, not internalize the things that came at you?
No. No. And interestingly enough, there was a, when the Operation Exodus program ended, there was an assessment of how well the program did. And they said, you know, academically, the students did well, or they did okay. But they didn't really address the emotional toll.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And my parents were dealing with their own set of stuff.
Yeah.
And so we didn't have those kinds of conversations.
Oh, okay.
When we were accused of cheating or whatever, my parents would come up to the school and then meet with the teachers.
Right.
But as a child, I felt that they were powerless or, that there wasn't really anything that could be done.
Yeah.
And I didn't feel that, I could actually share, like, emotionally, this is what's going on for me.
Yeah.
With them.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think partly is that I think that their intentions were good.
Yeah.
They wanted the best for us. And I think that for me and my siblings, like, we wanted to be the best that we could for them.
Well, I don't know, because different people, when trauma comes at people, it comes at them in different ways. And this seems like it came to you from five or six different directions.
Mm-hmm.
You spoke
mm-hmm.
about your religious background and living in on the East Coast like that. And then in chapter 1, under wounds, on page 17, your healing journey begins when you come down south.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's interesting that it would start then.
You know what? My healing journey happened, before that, in terms of some of the work and group work that I was involved in, and counseling that I even had myself. So I saw a counselor. I worked through a lot of this stuff. When I went to the South, that it just went deeper. That what you're reading there was just I was surprised at what came up, and I think it's interesting because, for folk in the South, it may feel like the folk in the North, it's that we have it better, or
yeah.
I'm not sure what people think, but the fact that in Boston, the percentage of black folk is really small.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I think, 12% or something crazy like that
mm-hmm.
of black people.
Mm-hmm.
So we are in this environment where there's like this little small group, in terms of trying to work through and navigate, like, being in this, in like, majority
mm-hmm.
white environment was a really difficult thing. And for us, my parents later, became Christians, and so the church was an integral part of healing for me.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
that trip to Montgomery, wow.
Yeah, well, that certainly had to be eye opening, and I'm from Kansas. You can't get any whiter than that. So
yeah.
I get it. I'm 100%. I get you. I understand. Yeah. Because it's not what people think at all.
Right.
And knowing that is the case, you carried that with you for quite some time, and that's part of the story that you tell in your book. And mm-hmm. you go into speaking about fatigue. When did you know that you just were tired and you just couldn't deal with this and it was time for you to move on into something else?
Yeah. You know what? I think that there are various points along the way where, I think in being in majority white spaces, whether it was college, obviously through school, through primary school, high school, college, and then afterwards, and then having my own family and having to deal with my kids in school and seeing what they were faced with.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a way in which I felt weary even then. And, we spent 10 years in South Africa, in Johannesburg.
Mm.
And so from 2005 to 2016, we were out of the country.
Mm.
And so... Which is interesting. So the Obama years we weren't here.
Okay.
We came back at the tail end of it.
Uh-huh.
But while we were there, I think there was a bit of a distance and a way to kind of also heal on a deeper level because in Johannesburg, most of the people you see are black, and that was healing, in a way. But then we came back in 2016, and I quickly was tired again.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, coming from all fronts. Mm-hmm. And I think it's not just what I've experienced, but I notice that so many black folk, you know, and other people of color were being, you know, it was like relentless,
mm-hmm.
you know, whether it was coming through the president, mm-hmm. just society. People seem mm-hmm. to just have permission. You know, one of the things in the North, you know, they say that, okay, in the South you kind of know that people have issues, and in the North people can kind of hide it. You know,
they hide it, but they just do it different.
Oh,
it's
yeah,
it's
oh, yeah.
still that's there. They're doing it, just doing different. It different. That's it all.
yeah, it's different. And yeah. So what, you know, it was surprising in a way that it was really like people were given permission. They were given permission to mm-hmm. just say and do whatever they felt. And as a mother of two, you know, a black male child who's an adult now, mm-hmm. actually, and a daughter who's in college. Mm-hmm. But worrying about my children, worrying about my black husband, mm-hmm. And also just, you know, the vicarious trauma of just watching as mm-hmm. people, whether it's the police, you know, mm-hmm. shooting mm-hmm. of unarmed black men and women, just that became exhausting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, when you were in Johannesburg, is mm-hmm. that when you became a Christian? Was it? Were
no,
you
no.
still with your family then? Your parents?
No, I actually became a Christian after college.
Okay.
So although I attended church before then, I wouldn't say I. You know, it was like something to do on Sunday,
mm-hmm.
And it wasn't really something that I really owned and
mm-hmm.
would say that yes, that's who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened after college.
Mm-hmm. So does your book is, and even though I know that it does say in the description it's a ministry, is it used for the community of faith, or is it just used for whoever wants to learn more on the topic?
I think it's both.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it definitely is coming from a faith perspective,
mm-hmm.
Because that really is who I am. The stories that are shared in there are stories of people of faith.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, faith is an integral part of what it is that what I'm sharing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm addressing racial trauma and basically how it affects us spiritually, physically, emotionally,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
affects our choices in vocation, mm-hmm. how we care for ourselves and our community. And so I feel like anyone can you know, have takeaways from it, but it absolutely is firmly rooted in faith.
Okay. So we need to take a time out right now and take our first break, because when we come back, I want to go to chapter 4, which you go into beginning in 2 Samuel here, and the lesson that we can all learn from there that you are adding and why you included it in your book. Today's book, Healing Racial Trauma, The Road to Resilience, Sheila Wise Rowe is author and my guest. Let's take a time out and we'll be right back.
You're listening to What's the 411 with Sharon Kay.
What's the 411 with Sharon Kay is brought to you by Terry W. Jones, independent agent, State Farm Insurance. Life insurance is one of those subjects that makes people want to change the subject rather than admit they probably don't have enough. That's why State Farm agent Terry W. Jones focuses on how the benefits of life insurance actually live on by asking people to think in terms of life without having to sell the house, insurance, or life without having to give up college, insurance. Find out how the benefits of life insurance can live on for your family. Call State Farm agent Terry W. Jones in Nashville at 615-256-6066 or online at terrywjones.net and put the life back in life insurance.
This is the last weekend before Valentine's Day, and this weekend on Blue Slam in the City, it's all about love.
I took your advice and I gave my spouse a second chance.
Miss Jody's talking this weekend about how she's trying to save love from the stage. And of course, we'll play the best in love, blues, and southern soul. Join me, Rogene Bailey, for Blue Slam in the City this weekend right here. Catch Blue Slam in the City Sundays from 8 to 10 p.m. right here on Jazzy 88.
Support for WFSK comes from TPAC, presenting world-renowned Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater in two new programs featuring three Nashville premieres and Ailey's joyful classic, Revelations, closing each performance. Coming to TPAC February 28th and 29th. Tickets available at TPAC.org.
Olivia. From Washington. Laid off and trying to keep our little kids from realizing that mommy and daddy haven't eaten in a while.
Roger, from California. I'm grateful we could afford our son's surgery. I'm nervous that now we can't really afford food.
Daniel, from California. Choosing whether to pay the rent or pay to fix the car to get to work doesn't leave us with much at all. Now we can't even pay for meals.
Donna from Louisiana. The storm just hit, and we went from donating to the food bank to needing it.
Keisha from South Carolina. I've been skipping meals so my two kids can eat, but filling up on water doesn't really work.
Hunger is a story we can end. End it at feedingamerica.org. Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Adopt US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the Lingo.
GOAT, G-O-A-T, acronym, stands for Greatest of All Time. As in, spaghetti sandwiches for dinner? They're my fave. Dad, you're the GOAT.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org. Brought to you by the US Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt US Kids, and the Ad Council.
This has been a reminder from community-minded Jazzy 88 WFSK.
One with Sharon Kay is brought to you by Terry W. Jones, independent agent, State Farm Insurance. Life insurance is one of those subjects that makes people want to change the subject rather than admit they probably don't have enough. That's why State Farm agent Terry W. Jones focuses on how the benefits of life insurance actually live on by asking people to think in terms of life without having to sell the house, insurance, or life without having to give up college, insurance. Find out how the benefits of life insurance can live on for your family. Call State Farm agent Terry W. Jones in Nashville at 615-256-6066 or online at terrywjones.net and put the life back in life insurance.
Keep up with the guests and topics on What's the 411 with Sharon Kay. Friend us on Facebook and Twitter. Search under Sharon Kay's 411.
It's What's the 411. Here again, Sharon Kay.
I am so grateful to have you all listening this morning. Let me remind you that What's the 411 with Sharon Kay is brought to you by Terry W. Jones, independent agent, State Farm Insurance. We thank you so very much for supporting What's the 411. Today it is The Road to Resilience, Healing Racial Trauma. It's a new book out that many of you may want to pick up and gain some insight from if you're dealing with issues of abuse and trauma. Sheila Wise Rowe is the author and the guest today. She is a counselor and has ministered to abuse and trauma survivors in both the United States and Johannesburg, South Africa. Is this your first book, Sheila?
No. My husband and I, we wrote a book called The Well of Life.
Okay.
And that was more of a healing curriculum.
Okay.
Yeah, that we...
Does it go with this one?
Well, it doesn't in that it deals with just trauma and relational brokenness on a bigger scale, and it's usually used in groups.
Oh, okay.
But individuals can buy it, read it. for themselves as well.
Okay, excellent. Hope you all pick them up. Chapter four is Rage. My, there is, you got a lot to say, and you're giving us some stories from 2 Samuel, Tamar, and many of you that's read, you know what this story is about, but go ahead and pick it up on page 54, chapter 4.
Yeah, so I start with the story of Tamar because it's really gives an illustration of what happens when we don't deal with rage, we don't deal with anger. And so the story is around King David and his children, and particularly his daughter Tamar, who was raped by her half-brother Amnon, and her brother Absalom, who, you know, is wanting the king to do something about this, and David refuses to, or he doesn't do it in a manner that Absalom feels that he should. And so what happens is that Absalom then, he plots the death of his brother. And his brother actually is killed. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, it causes an estrangement in the family with David and Absalom. Tamar doesn't process the rape. Mm-hmm. She basically, it says in the Bible that she spends the rest of her days as a desolate woman in Absalom's house.
Mm-hmm.
And I chose that because so often, you know, we are bombarded with, as I said earlier, issues around, we're personally experiencing racism, we're watching it vicariously, we don't know what to do with this, we're angry with what we see and what we've experienced, and we don't deal with it. And so we just push it in and push it in, and then, like Absalom, it erupts in some way. And it doesn't necessarily have to lead to murder, but it's destructive. And so, you know, that as a kind of a graphic example of the need to really look at the anger, look at the source of the anger, and to unpack that anger. One of the things that we often see is that when someone is stuck in anger, that there's grief underneath that's not being dealt with. And so, and in this case, you know, Absalom really loved his sister, you know, and to see his sister harmed in this way was grieving for him, but he went straight to anger. And we see the result of that.
And you go from rage to fear. Is that that what you've discovered in your counseling training to be the direction that you go in? Was it fight or flight?
Yeah, well, you know what? The chapters of the book really reflect the symptoms of racial trauma. So, you know, we start out with chapter one, which is just kind of overview of just the wounding that happens. And then the symptoms then follow. And that one is fatigue. Another symptom is silence. Rage is one. Fear. Lament or sorrow is one. Shame and addiction are symptoms that we see when there is racial trauma present. And so it's not sequential, but fear is definitely an issue. And, you know, it is a symptom of racial trauma, and, you know, in some ways it can be, you know, one where a person is anxious and fearful, and there isn't really anything externally that would make them that way. However, in the case of even the story, there are legitimate reasons why there's fear. And so one of the stories is actually my son, and the fear is around being a young black man in America, and it's a legitimate fear. And so how does, you know, his journey of walking that out and coming to understand, you know, what that fear is about, how does he navigate that? How does he find community and support for that? And then the other person is a member of the Shinnecock Nation, which is in on Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
And so as an Indigenous woman, the fear was more around just loss of home and place and cultural identity.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you know, because being a person of color in America. And I think that's the other piece about my book is that in each of these chapters,
mm-hmm.
These are friends of mine or family members, and they range in terms of they're black, they're there's Indigenous folk, there's biracial, Afro-Caribbean,
mm-hmm.
there's a South African story, there's a black millennial who lives in, you know, in the inner city. There's a woman who's older, they're younger. So it's a range.
Okay. Now, in dealing with this on your personally, did what kind of relationships have you had or do you have with non-people of color?
What's interesting is that, you know, I was at a church that, this is back in, probably the mid-90s,
mm-hmm.
Where an inner-city church in which there was a black pastor and a white pastor, mm-hmm. and they were co-pastoring,
mm-hmm.
and it attracted people who wanted to be a part of something that was modeling
mm-hmm.
What the church should look like,
mm-hmm.
And so out of that, there were friendships that were made, and
mm-hmm.
there were, you know, I had a counseling practice, and there were people who were members of the team
mm-hmm.
who were black and who were white and who were Latino, and it really was something that was surprising to people, and I often would have people
mm-hmm.
commenting because I was running this, and my husband, and they were saying, wow, you know what, I've not seen white people who submit to black leadership.
Mm.
And I think that it takes a certain kind of person to do that,
mm-hmm.
Who is willing to see that they don't have all the answers. And
mm-hmm.
I think that that's commonly an issue, is that,
mm-hmm.
you know, we may engage with white folk, but they seem to feel like they have all the answers.
Mm-hmm.
And so to, you know, I would say it's a blessing, but to be able to have white friends and those involved in ministry who
mm-hmm.
actually see the value that we all have
definitely.
To bring to the table.
Definitely. Well, having a diverse friendships or, you know, relationships with people certainly would, you know, knock down some stereotypes or would have been
yeah.
helpful. Do you urge people to engage in, you know, diversity and cross-cultural issues?
I do, to the extent that they can.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that for some, you know, it's difficult.
Mm-hmm.
It is difficult. I mean, I think as, you know, as a Christian, we at least have that part to...
True.
To lean on, although I would have to say that these days,
yeah.
that's
depends on where
yeah.
you go.
Exactly, right.
As to the messaging that you would certainly hear. Well, there's no surprise to me, Sheila, that you would include shame, a discussion
mm-hmm.
of shame,
yeah.
in your book. How do you
mm-hmm.
cover it as you look at resilience?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that I feel like is that, you know, messages have been communicated, whether they've been overt or they've been hidden
mm-hmm.
or subtle, and sometimes out in the open, that really demean black folk, demean Latinos,
mm-hmm.
you know, demean other folk of color. And there are ways in which what we have seen is just this kind of elevation of whiteness as like I write in the book about it being like the gold standard.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's what we all need to be aspiring to. And in that, what happens is that, you know, we get these messages, we think that that's what we need to be aspiring to, and yet we're blocked at every turn.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is that, you know, we end up having like a shame-based identity, mm-hmm. where, you know, shame is different than guilt. Guilt says you did something wrong. Shame says mm-hmm. that you are wrong. Mm-hmm. And so we walk around with this, and it can be very unconscious, mm-hmm. But this general sense of, like, there's something wrong with me. I don't belong here. I talk in that chapter about the imposter syndrome, that, you know, you're on a university campus, mm-hmm. and that for some of your students, they may feel that way. They may walk around feeling like, I either don't belong here, or they graduate and it's, you know, they're in a work situation, mm-hmm. and they're getting, you know, they're either picking up some stuff in the environment, mm-hmm. or they come in too with this sense of, you know, do I have what it takes? It's this nagging question. Mm-hmm. And that needs to be addressed. That healing needs to happen in dealing with how we perceive ourselves.
Well, they seem to be more concerned, in my opinion, about clothes and hair weave, yes. and things of that nature, more so than, you know, because a lot of them that I've met over the years of being here have a strong cultural background in terms of they know blackness and they mm-hmm. want to be in it. That's why they're here. Yeah. They're not, to them, there is no white gold standard. This is the height of the education process, is being on an HBCU campus. They come yeah. really with a lot of pride. Those that don't mm-hmm. feel that way, they wouldn't end up here anyway. I just see, I just can't see them. You know, they wouldn't want to, now they'll go to Ivy League school, they'll go over to Vanderbilt. And mm-hmm. But would never end up. It takes special people to be in HBCUs because they got, you know, they don't want to be in that. They don't buy into that. So mm-hmm. that's one of the things I will say about them, is that they have strong,
so
they,
I'm interested
strong
about
identity.
Your comment about the weaves and the clothing.
Yeah. It's true.
Yeah.
They start looking different, you know, when they're freshmen, and they might look the way they look from whatever part of the country they're from. But, mm-hmm. you know, when they get to university, they start changing, you know, doing makeup mm-hmm. and eyelashes and big banging eyelashes and fake fingernails and all the trendy stuff that, mm-hmm. you know, that is in culturally is in style right now. They, mm-hmm. you know, after the first couple of months, you notice people's hair is no longer like it was when they first got here. Like, mm-hmm. what happened to you? So, I mean, it's that noticeable. And
mm-hmm. But you know what? So I have a question. So I always wonder, when lots of effort is being put on externals, yeah. what is going on internally?
Well, that's true.
And this is not to say that, you know, I'm assuming that there is shame underneath there. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it does lead me to wonder uh-huh. what is going on.
Yeah.
The reality is that, you know, if someone is, you know, they're going to graduate, you know, they may work for a black company.
Yeah.
They may not. That... there's a line in my book where I say, you know, when you go into a job and you feel like, you know, it's mostly white in terms of your boss and the company is predominantly white, and you go in with that whole questioning, mm-hmm. you know, the imposter piece.
Right.
And the hard part is when you go into, you know, you go into a place with an imposter syndrome, but kind of feeling that mm. in a place where they are communicating on some level that you are an imposter.
Uh-huh.
That's a hard place to be in.
Yeah. Well, what I'm noticing as I make that statement is braids up here
mm-hmm.
that they
mm-hmm.
didn't have before. And it's mm-hmm. more of a cultural slant.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
you know, just because you're black doesn't mean you're ghetto. So,
yeah.
You know, they're constantly working against that stereotype.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
they just gravitate more toward programs that the African American, the Black community would be interested in, speakers and marches and rallies and different things of that nature. Versus you know, being somewhere where you hardly hear the subject come up at all. Does that make sense?
No, yeah, it totally does. It does, and in a way that, you know, embracing, you know, our cultural identity is, that's an important piece of who we are.
And
that's a good thing.
Definitely.
And I think that where that's happening on, you know, campuses like yours, and it's not happening elsewhere,
just
because, you know, as you said, people are going to, whether it's Ivy League or they're going to, you know, a small college up in the north somewhere, and, you know, in the west or Midwest.
Yeah. And they're,
you know, they're not getting that message.
Right.
They're not getting that sense of community.
Right.
They're having to really create that.
Yeah. Well, they just believe the ice water's colder over there. and unfortunately, it's the same ice water. Now, Chapter 10, Resilience, is you are in here talking about a healing support group that you ran at a church in Boston. What happened?
Yeah.
What was going on?
Well, it was actually the first time that we ran the group, and so I share that there actually was, as I said, the number of Black people in Boston was really small, so the group was diverse. It was in the inner city, in Dorchester, and you had people who were coming from different areas, and even the suburbs, and there were some white folks, some Black folks, some Latino folk, and as the group ended, the front doors of the church burst open, and a young man stumbled into the foyer of the church, and he had been shot, we found out.
Wow.
So there had been a drive-by shooting outside, and he managed to drag himself to the church, and he falls and collapses in the middle of it. Now, we had just finished our group, our groups, and so I think we may have had about, like, four or five small groups, and so all the groups were being let out, and there's a scene unfolding in the lobby, in the entryway, and the police are there, and the EMTs, and so we were all kind of pushed into the sanctuary while this happened, and it was a dramatic thing, because it really was one of the people who were there having to really count the cost of, is this worth it? And I think that for some of the white folk who came in from the suburbs, it was like, well, this was like their worst nightmare.
Yeah, of course.
And questions about, you know, is this a place where they really are going to be able to receive, you know, and, you know, get some healing and get some help. And it was a challenge for them. But after, you know, a week of, I think, people really thinking, praying, talking to their families, they all did return. But it was a very dramatic start to the group.
Well, I would say if that's the first one you're conducting, it happens like that. It was like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
that clearly. And so the group's still going strong?
Yeah, well, that, you know, people were doing a group for a number of weeks, and then we stopped, and then we start again. So we've been running groups for years. We, the Well of Life book that I mentioned earlier is the curriculum. We've done that in South Africa. It still is running there. We've done it a couple of times since we've been back, and so people have taken the book, and they've either run their own groups, and that's, you know, even around the country, people have just taken it and done that, or you know, two friends have gotten together and worked through the workbook together.
Yeah.
Because it really looks at what are, like, some really early stuff that kind of has shaped, and faith-based, shaped, like, how we perceive ourselves, how we interact with other people.
Right.
You know, yeah.
And you give, at the end of the chapter, reflections and prayer prompts.
Yes.
And so there is an opportunity for people to take this as a workbook, right? Was that your intent? Okay, good.
Yeah, definitely. So, and that, if you actually look at the end of the book, there actually is a group guide. So it ended up being divvied up to like four different sessions, which is probably shorter than it should be. But So if a small group said, okay, let's read the book and let's do four sessions of this and kind of go through it,
right.
You have the questions there. And the questions are really getting at some of these, you know, when we look at the symptoms of racial trauma, like where is that being manifest in your life?
Mm-hmm.
And what needs to happen with that? What do you need to do?
Mm-hmm.
I think that one of the things also is just, you know, there's a lot of talk about the need to reduce stigma,
mm-hmm.
Particularly in black churches,
mm-hmm.
And not even just churches, black communities, mm-hmm. around counseling and people getting help. And as a counselor, absolutely,
truly,
that needs to happen. However, the reality is that there really are not enough black therapists.
Yeah.
And so we've got to figure out some way on a continuum to offer support,
mm-hmm.
for people who maybe they don't need to really see a therapist,
right.
At least not yet, but they need some support.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, one of the things I talk about are hush harbors, and that during the slavery period, there were these spaces where black folk, you know, the enslaved would go and pray and worship and,
mm-hmm.
also, you know, strategize about,
mm-hmm.
freedom and,
yeah.
you know, who's leaving when. And, you know, in terms of escaping,
mm-hmm.
and, but as a safe space,
mm-hmm.
to be able to pray, to process through, to talk,
mm-hmm.
honestly about what we're struggling,
mm-hmm.
with. And there are many ways in which the church has been that, as a place for people to, share,
mm-hmm.
and to really feel like, okay, on this Sunday, I could just kind of be. And I feel that there are ways in which we need to kind of look at what happened in the past, whether it was in the church or even in terms of how we lived,
mm-hmm.
in communities, that actually was and did contribute towards resilience. Because there's no way that we can go through what we went through and still, you know what I mean, without there having been something.
Of course, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so I think that we tend to not look at that. And we just jump to, well, okay, what are the new things that, you know, and there are great things in terms of being more mindful or all of that, but there are things that worked,
yeah.
as well. And
yeah.
so identifying what those are.
Yeah. Well, that, I had the privilege, like so many others, to sit in a workshop with Dr. Joy DeGruy, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, that... slave syndrome is like, whew, it blows your hair back, you know, because she does nail it, you know, between the eyes for what it is and what it has done to people. So all of you all that are doing this great work, thank you. Thank all of y'all that are doing it, because people need it, and they need it not just on one side of the aisle, but on the other side as well. Today's book,
yeah.
Healing Racial Trauma, The Road to Resilience, and I have been enjoying my discussion today with Sheila Wise Rowe. She is a psychology counselor and has ministered to abuse and trauma survivors in the United States and Johannesburg, South Africa. For people to find out more, Sheila, about your work as a spiritual director, counselor, speaker, writer, etc., what's the best place that you would say to go?
I would say my website. So it's
okay.
SheilaWiseRowe.com.
Okay.
Pretty easy. Yeah, all of the information is there, and you can leave a message. Send me an email message. I'd be happy to talk.
And maybe they might share a story or so with you, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. And one of the things that I'm also doing in terms of promoting the book is getting out there and talking, you know, on campuses and in churches and in other spaces around racial trauma.
Good for you. Because that's the only way we're talking about it. It's the only way change is going to come. Get this off our chest.
Absolutely.
And move
Absolutely.
On. Sheila, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And
thank you for having me.
I hope that you have a good rest of the day.
You too. Take care.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Oh, bye-bye. Today's book is part of a theme of books I've had having this month for Black History Month,
mm-hmm.
on my Sunday's editions of the show. You know, we just want to encourage the community of faith to get the cracking jack. Come on, baby. Because they're going to be integral.
That's right.
Making the change come. And so thank you to Sheila.
Mm-hmm.
And the church where I'm going today, I'm going to give the pastor the closet today.
That's right.
And, yeah. You know, he's getting ready to get a library. Oh, yeah. He's getting ready to get a library. He doesn't know.
Now, for people who may want to come, where is that again?
It's at Madison Square. I think it's 752 Madison Square.
Okay. And the name of the church is?
Covenant of the Cross.
Covenant of the Cross. Right. There it is.
So, anyway, now, at 6 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
The, on Wednesday, going to carry the theme a little further with our friend Dr. Herbert Harris.
He's back.
Long time since the 12 Secret 12 Laws of Success man has been on. But he's got his new book on solutions.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody seems to have some solutions, but it's the laborers where the intro is. Come on, get busy. And then the photos of the photographer Ernest Withers.
Oh,
from Memphis.
Yeah.
The new book on some not yet released historic photos of the civil rights movement.
Yeah, that's going to be something
else.
Oh,
yes. That's a heavy book. It's heavy, heavy. Anyway, you know, and also earlier we had a few minutes of discussion on you know, this threat thing on Gayle King. And, you know, I just wish y'all would just stop trying to threaten to kill somebody and take them out and all that. You know, because she got death. She's getting death threats. I'm like,
that's
awful. What sense does that make? I mean, you know, what sense does it make to threaten to kill somebody? I mean, that is stupid. Plus, you know, illegal over something like this, really? Why not just sign up for the military, you know, all the hot air folk, and go fight for your country? But, you know. But anyway, some of the other side, though, is, you know, the CBS News had once a full investigation into these threats against her, because she has to be with security now. I mean, you know, that is just so off the chart. This country needs to exhale like crazy. Everybody is on level 62 all the time. Y'all need to, you tick, tick, boom every minute. Tick, tick, boom. That's everybody. Come on, y'all. That's what's wrong with the can't get nothing done, divided, mad, evil. And, you know, everybody, you know, and, you know, this thing is just really getting out of control. It really, really, really is. And, you know, you start saying, I'm going to kill you because you see it or whatever.
Yeah.
There's no reason for this. You know, there's absolutely no reason for, you know, the threats and, you know. Because that stuff ain't no joke when somebody says they're going to kill you.
It's not.
Okay?
It's not.
That ain't no joke. That ain't nothing to play with. And, you know, so that was wondering. She wasn't on the thing Friday, Thursday or Friday.
Wow.
Because I didn't see her. I was like, one of this has something to do with it. She probably scared.
Yeah.
You know, because you don't know who's, you know, issuing these threats. So, you know, maybe... when an investigation, but on the other side of this, folks are saying that CBS pushed the envelope by highlighting
that portion of the interview,
and you know,
and, so and they ratcheted it up. They did it out of context,
right.
And made it seem like she was going for the jugular with that particular. Especially so, coming on the heels of what we talked about, the R. Kelly situation, that just heightened everything.
And hyping breaking news every minute. Tick, tick, boom. I mean, that's everybody. Just... So, you know, I see the ball is both sides of the aisle. people, you know, network, calm down too. Because this is not good. It's just not good to have, you know, black women are fighting each other, and, you know, Cory Booker's in it now, and Susan Rice, and all these other people have come to, you know, Gail's defense.
But it also begs to ask the question, if a person has been accused of something and they settle out of court, it has nothing to do with whether he did it or didn't do it, but is it right to bring it back up?
But she's not the only person that's brought it up.
But I'm just saying, I'm just talking about in general, in this Me Too era, you know, is it, you know?
Well, you know, I'm just saying that, you know, folks are going to find the dirt.
Yeah.
When somebody's still telling the story about your history, they're not going to always have a glowing report. Okay,
In that context, if it was a documentary or a look back over Kobe's life like that, I think it might be proper. But in the context of this particular interview at this particular time, when is a good time?
Well, and then like with Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
The same thing.
Yeah.
So when anybody dies, you're emotional to the ceiling anyway.
Yeah.
And then you throw in memories or whatever your rationale and reasoning is. And he was super popular. You know, just incredibly popular. Yeah. So
he managed to turn his life around for the better.
He did. And that's the story that will be finally told.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's why, you know, behavior from start to finish is what's up.
Crucial.
Yeah, it is. You know, it's hard to keep your nose clean at all times. And just ask people who've had to do it.
That's true.
Because everybody got bones up in the closet. Yeah.
CBS and should not be.
They got bones in the closet,
too.
Okay.
Didn't a few people had to run for the exit?
They had bones in the closet.
And a few executive CEOs.
So I'm saying, whose closet is boneless? Whose closet is bone-free? Okay. Yeah. I'd like to have a talk with Chip.
And recently, right? Wasn't this a few years ago? Yeah.
Anyway, so, I mean, whose closet is bone-free? No one. Anyway, all right, Nashville, that's all I have for you. You all have the of every best of the best, and that's A-L-L for you. You all have the very best of the best, and don't forget, who loves you?
You've been listening to What's the 411 with Sharon Kay. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station and its management.
You're listening to What's the 411 with Sharon Kay?